Hello and a very hearty welcome to a new episode of Lessons to Grow, your podcast for good corporate leadership. You might be quite surprised because I'm starting in English. And the reason is that today this is a debut in two ways. First of all, it's our first podcast episode in English. And secondly, it's a C-level interview on good corporate leadership. And as a guest today, we have Adela Sakau from Gartner Group. And what she has to say about good corporate leaderships is going to come right after the intro.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Armin. Really nice to be here. It's a pleasure to be part of this podcast.
Hello, Adela. Welcome to Lessons to Grow. I'm really happy to have you. Adela, would you maybe like to start by introducing yourself briefly?
Happy to. And once again, thank you for the invitation. I'm quite excited to chat with you, Armin. And hopefully it's going to be an interesting perspective that I'd like to share from my experience. But take a step back. Let me introduce myself. So I spent my early years in Romania. Mm-hmm. Actually, my hometown is quite famous, if I can say so. So I come from Onești, which is also the hometown of Nadia Comăneci.
Ah, yes. The first 10.
The first perfect 10. Yes, absolutely. Yes. So that's my hometown, and my parents worked in the, you know, an energy plant in the area, of course, and they did the best they could, you know, to provide the best for me and my younger two brothers. And from a very early age, I was quite fascinated about learning. And for my parents not having the tools, this was an interesting trick, right? But because they didn't know how to handle it, but I was very motivated, self-driven. I would be interested in competitions, mathematics, literature, whatnot. And I was fortunate enough to study computer science in the best university in Romania, Polytechnica University in Bucharest, which was, how can I say, it took me to a next level. I started then working as a software engineer for an American company. And the step that actually changed the trajectory of my career was when I joined Romtelecom, then Telecom Romania, as part of Deutsche Telekom. I started as a software engineer. When I went back years later, they were still using the software I produced. I was very proud of, very, very proud of this, right? But I was fortunate enough to be included in the team that handled the most strategic programs back then. And I'm talking about launching a mobile network. I'm talking about launching IPTV on an Ericsson platform. So I'm talking about 2006, 2007, 2008. So quite innovative things. And as a result, I got exposure to Deutsche Telekom, which awarded me, recognized that I'm a top talent and awarded me with a Master's of Science in Enterprise Information Management at Henley Business. And Armin, you and I, we have this in common. You're an alumnus as well, right?
That's it, yes.
And fast forward, I did not want to come to Germany, but here I am right now. I'm based out of Frankfurt, so still Germany had me a bit later. I've decided to move to London. While I was doing this Master's of Science, I've decided to move to London, and I was very fortunate to join. I think I was amongst the top five people that was NDA'd at EE, Everything Everywhere, the joint venture between T-Mobile and Orange.
Yeah.
I think I was very fortunate. Some remarkable people were there, absolutely amazing people. And I've seen firsthand what it means, exceptional leadership. And I'll talk about this a bit more, right?
Yeah.
So not only that we were launching for the first time 4G in Europe, but we would also add, we worked with Kevin Bacon and, you know, we would create a brand, EE brand, which was a phenomenon. Now it's part of BT, right? The EE is part of BT, but it was absolutely amazing. And the people I used to work with back then are in top positions in Europe and not only. So I've got exposure to phenomenal people. And this was truly an inflection point for my career. So both the masters, the Henley Business School masters, which created a completely different perspective in terms of what technology can do and how you should look at growth and at business. I've seen executives talk about pragmatic examples and you know, lessons learned and guidance. It was phenomenal. And then I've seen this in reality at EE. So for me, that time, that specific time, has been a perfect platform for me to kickstart my career in a completely different way, right? Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've been in tech. I've spent more than a decade in London. I focused on, you know, learning. I still enjoy learning. I like to be surrounded by smart people, smarter than I am, and learn, transform, and become the best version of myself. I did join Gartner because I wanted exposure to other industries and I wanted to help other companies sort their problems, right? And I thought it's a very good fit to join, especially after the EE experience, to join Gartner. And I was not wrong, to be honest. I'm still enjoying what I do. And for those of you that are not familiar, maybe just introduce Gartner a bit.
Yep.
So Gartner is a global organization. It's a $6.3 billion dollar company. So quite a sizable organization. I think our CEO Gene Hall, it's a genius. There are some challenges, but I think a lot of companies are rebalancing right now. And what we do, we provide strategic insights to executives, right? So we help companies solve their problems, be it going to markets, grow, or optimize cost, or reshuffle operating models. So very, very interesting spectrum of work that we do. And as I said, I think it's a phenomenal organization, and I'm happy to be here.
Perfect. What is your exact role at Gartner as a managing partner?
So at the moment, I came to Frankfurt in 2019. Mm-hmm. Because my husband is American and he couldn't move to London. Therefore, I came to Germany. As I said, here I am in Germany, fast forward, and I'm happy I'm here. Mm-hmm. As a managing partner, I work with C-level leaders from a number of industries, right? So my portfolio is quite broad. I work with executives from telcos, from high tech, semiconductors, professional services organizations, technology services providers, and defense organizations.
Interesting.
It's a very broad spectrum of clients, right? And what I do, I leverage my almost 2 decades international experience to help, you know, organizations with digital transformation, the advisory that they need, and strategic insights, because that's what we do. That's what we do at Gartner, right?
Perfect. Coming to our topic, Adela, Lessons to Grow is about, you know, leadership, corporate leadership. That's the core topic. How do you define good leadership today, and what separates the bad from the good and the good from the excellent?
The question is absolutely on point. And Armin, if you allow me, I will take a step back.
Yeah.
Just reflecting on the introduction that I made, right? So if I learned something in this almost 2 decades worth of experience, having been exposed to some interesting organizations, mm-hmm. pure organizations, if I can say so, is the fact that and I've been gravitating around the same principle of sustainable growth to relate it to your podcast, of course.
Yeah.
And sustainable growth is not just from a revenue perspective. It can be, that's the objective, but it's also about governance, right? And I've had, as I said, I was fortunate to work on some of the most strategic initiatives in the past. And recently I even helped technology companies create the plans to build the infrastructure, the data center infrastructure in the global south. So I'm talking about very strategic, major global expansions, right? transform operating models and whatnot. So if I were to take one thing that I've learned over these years, and I'm not here to give advice, I'm here to have a conversation. Maybe one key takeaway for business leaders is exactly this. Work with your board. Work with your board, not as a compliance burden, but make it your partner. And I will give a bit more examples as our conversation evolves alongside this topic. Make it a strategic engine to achieve your objectives, because this is key. This is absolutely key, right? Now, if I come back to your question, what is corporate governance, right? What is corporate leadership, good corporate leadership? Let's look at the leaders today. I mean, at Gartner, we like to define terms. We are known for this, right? A leader is basically an individual who has a position and responsibility over a number of people, be it frontline, be it C-level. This is what a leader is. And what we find at Gartner, we see how organizations change today, right? And what leaders have to do, they must adapt and integrate two types of leadership: enterprise leadership and human leadership. What do I mean by this? I'm not trying to sound too academic, or just to clarify the.
Please go on. It's extremely interesting.
So the enterprise leadership is the what. What do leaders have to deliver? What are those capabilities? What are those goals? What are those ambitions, levers that they have to achieve? And how they work with the internal resources of the organization to actually achieve this collective performance. So this is enterprise leadership. Human leadership, which is gaining more and more momentum, this is about the how, right? So if we have the what, the how do you work with your team? How do you ensure connection? Are you an empathetic leader? Can you connect with your team? Can you adapt to the situation? This is gaining more and more momentum, right? So just to baseline a bit the definition of there are different types of leadership, of course, but from a Gartner perspective, this is how we look at enterprise and human leadership. To come back to your original question, so what is good corporate leadership? From my perspective, it's a combination of three components, right? Especially nowadays, and then it's a VUCA environment. It's a very dynamic environment. It's a combination, and you have to balance simultaneously these three things. It's about performance, people, and purpose. And I will give you an example, because I think it's always easier not to sound too academic. I like to bring it to life a bit too.
Very, very good. I'm enjoying it, so please keep going.
Sounds good, Armin. So so as I said, good corporate leadership entails balancing simultaneously these three components: performance, results matter, purpose, and people. I've been supporting for a number of years since I came to Germany, but again, my role is wider than German market.
Yeah,
I've been supporting this high-tech organization, and the team was in many parts of the business, many in many business units of the organization. Because again, we've been working for a long time with them, and we had this intimacy, right? Mm. The company was very successful, and they still are successful, but as a result of the uncertainty and what's happening now with the market, with the tariffs and whatnot, their market performance dropped significantly. I'm talking here about billions that they lost in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So what did the leadership do? Unfortunately, I will not be able to disclose the name of this company, but that's not the point, right? The point is to look at this example. They cracked on with the same strategy, and they said, you know what, we are going to continue growing, we're going to keep doing what we are doing, and we are going to be phenomenal. So as if nothing happened, right? Complete ignoring the situation. For me, that was not good enough. Mm-hmm. And knowing the organization well enough, I said, we have a duty to actually look at what are those structural failure points in this organization so that we help them, first of all, correct the decline, and second, help them bounce back, right, in the market. So there are two different things. And we found a number of reasons why this company, why the performance was dropping. So first of all, they had a very poor qualitative and quantitative intelligence, almost nothing. They were obsessed of getting the forecasts perfect, but not understanding what the root cause is, right? So the leadership had this strange way of looking at the forecast data and the intelligence they had on hand. Not only that, the decisions that they were making in terms of products that they were doing were very myopic. The priorities of the C-levels, they were all over the place. And the operating model was not necessarily geared up to what we are discussing here about an effective corporate leadership, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, so you found the root cause. We found it externally. So what do we do now? How do we go back? We actually went back to the leadership, to the CEO of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a traditional person, if I can say so. Mm-hmm. And we had a candid conversation. We explained it's important as a leader to keep an eye on what's going on the market, understand what's happening as a root cause, what are the structural failure points in your organization, what options you have. So we put on the table three options, three growth paths. We said, look, you can stay as is. You can, at heart, all these people, they're engineers, super bright people. So exceptionally good people, right? Engineers. And they had this ego, like our products are the best. We have these cash cow clients. We continue doing what we do and we are super successful. And I said, you can continue doing this and you can see the decline going even further down, right? You can look at what your peers are doing and then maybe you will grow in line with your industry, which is still not helping you bounce back from where you've declined. So that's not necessarily an option. Or what you could do, you could equip the market in such a way that you go out there and you shape it. And then that's when you tap into double-digit growth. That's where the beauty sits. But to do that, you have to institutionalize some sort of a modern go-to-market approach because your marketing team is non-existent. Your sales team is not effective. Your internal organization is all over the place. To our surprise, this was so well received. And this CEO recognized, I am not good at adapting my organization. I don't know how to do so. This is why I put forward the same messages I did over the years, but I actually need to recalibrate. So this example is not bad leadership. It's an example of you can be successful and still at some point to drop the ball.
Mm-hmm.
But having the courage to actually adapt, that's what good leadership means. And if you look at this example, I actually touched upon performance because numbers matter to the shareholders. The people, his talent wasn't there from marketing perspective. The engineers couldn't do the marketing job. They couldn't, regardless how great you were. And the purpose was there. They still wanted to be a leading organization, but they couldn't articulate the new narrative. That was the main challenge, right? Just to give a brief example, right?
Very interesting. And I think one important trait that you use or that you mentioned here is the capacity, you know, to take criticism positively and to put yourself into question, to put your organization into question and, you know, to be open for that, because otherwise it's going to be even worse.
Absolutely.
I would say.
Absolutely.
So as you have already mentioned, you're working with so many leaders each and every day, C-level executives mostly. What are the major challenges that they are facing today? You know, we're talking geopolitical crises, we're talking instability, economic crises to climate change, and let alone the whole AI, how should I say, hysteria. These are in general some challenges, but what would you say, you know, how what do they have to focus on? What are the major things that they have to cope with nowadays?
And you are absolutely right, Armin. There are so many things out there. How do you focus on the things that truly shift the dial, on the things that truly matter, the essential things? And also, when we talk about the challenges that leaders face nowadays, these challenges are not isolated entities. They are not standalone islands, if I can say so. These are interconnected challenges, right? What we find at Gartner, you cannot really just address one thing and it's going to be a domino effect and it's all great. You have to work on addressing not one problem, but how they function in an integrated manner. So this is the challenge that leaders have. But I would like to take two lenses, if I may, to answer this question related to the challenges that leaders face today. The first thing that comes to my mind is, if I take this external perspective, then I focus also on internally how I just to structure a bit the conversation. So externally, you mentioned AI, right? So one of the biggest challenges that leaders face today is this technology challenge. Technology is and things happen at a pace which is unprecedented, right? You named AI, Gen AI, right? Look at the scope, the speed. And what we see working with various organizations, yes, leaders are under pressure. Just taking this area as an example, leaders are under a lot of pressure to adopt AI and tap into productivity gains, right? And also prove measurable ROI. But then the rules have not caught up. I mean, yes, there is an EU AI Act, but what else? How do you create this ethical AI ethical setup? How do you ensure AI governance, right? You need all this, because the risk is, if you don't do all this, you'll expose your company to a number of risks, legal, reputational, operational type of risk, which are very difficult to correct in the future, right? So major risks associated if you're rushing to it, right? So just AI is an example. Then the other thing that I'm thinking is talent. Right now, if the rules have been rewritten since the COVID, since the pandemics, the way the employer-employee relationship, it's the traditional way of engaging, it's completely changed. Not to mention like skills that were 5 years ago relevant, right now completely obsolete if you add the AI spin onto it, right? And not just AI, you can take other type of technologies as well. What should leaders do in this? How can they reskill their workforce? How can they lead massive workforces in light of all these changes happening at the same time, right? So how can they address this talent reskilling or closing the gap? Or what does it mean, fit for future skill set? What are the emerging roles? How do we make sure that we prepare for those roles? And how do we make sure I'm not losing my top talent? Because a top talent will want a career with a purpose, will want the growth to be highlighted. And if you cannot do that, they will leave, right? This is the risk that comes with this type of talent challenge. If I look from an internal perspective, so most of the challenges for leaders are not necessarily external. The biggest challenges are internally related. So I'm talking here about organizational psychology. I'm talking about the trust and a couple of examples just to bring it to life, right? There is this dilemma: how do you balance short-term performance versus long-term resilience? I mean, the leaders I'm working with are measured regularly, some on monthly basis, some on a quarterly basis. These people are under a lot of scrutiny to actually show results and performance. And at the same time, the same people are being asked to take some long-term massive investments, R&D investments, climate resilience investments, or like massive long-term. So how do you balance this type of view? And so, yeah, I mean, you want to ask something?
No, I'm listening.
So this is the looking at showing results while also gearing up the organization. At the same time, right, looking at how you blend these machines with the humans, how you lead this augmented humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one, if you are familiar with Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA.
Yeah.
For me, he's absolutely an inspirational leader.
Yes.
He's an example of how you can lead a workforce, right? How you can lead a workforce from a massive workforce, not to be scared of technology. Actually, he's pushing his teams to use AI and to use technology because his mantra is, if you are scared that the machines will replace your job, you are wrong. You should be afraid of the person who uses AI. He's going to take your job, right? And creating this type of harmonious way in which people adopt technology and they work in a good harmony with machines and they add value, I think this is absolutely phenomenal. And one more point that I would like to add also from internal, which is a very big issue that we find at Gartner. So the short-term performance and the long-term resilience. But if we also look at is data-driven decision-making, data, everything is data, right? So if we look at this data-driven decision-making versus human intuition, I think I can call it intuition.
Yeah.
Data is the new currency. I mean, data, if we look at defense, data is the new weapon, if we think about it, right? But let's not talk defense. Let's just call it data is the currency. What we find that the most strategic decisions that leaders are making actually are qualitative, right? And quite messy. So why is this happening? So why data is not the answer? First of all, we have almost perfect dashboards, data analytics for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So every company, you name it, I want to know how I'm performing from this perspective. I want a dashboard. Everybody wants dashboards. Everybody wants to look at analytics, which is great. I mean, yes, data, we have to rely and have data-driven decision, data-driven enterprises, whatnot. But the challenge with that is that the data that resides in those dashboards is historical data. If you look at revenues, it's profits, like it's all historical. These are lagging indicators and they are missing the forward-looking leading indicators, right? That should support decision-making. And I think you know this better than I do, Armin, right? How important this is. But that's not actually the problem. The problem is that when we are human and we want to look at data, and a lot of us are very mesmerized by data, and we end up in an analysis paralysis, right? We just, that's not the point. What leaders do, and that's actually a very big challenge for a lot of organizations, what leaders, good leaders do, they actually leverage data, but they leverage it in the way where they can create frame of context to their board, where they can talk some about some hypotheses, assumptions, if you want. And they can pressure test those assumptions with their board so that they make sound decisions. Think about the most strategic breakthrough decisions, getting into a new market, deploying a new product and whatnot. These are decisions that require courage, intelligence, and empathy. It's not the actual data, the mechanics of the data. So it's a very interesting, what's happening right now with data in organization, it can be a phenomenal asset, but at the same time, it can also be a huge challenge for the leaders nowadays.
Very, very, very interesting. Adela, you talked about using the board at the very beginning of our conversation. That brings me to a topic which is called governance and compliance. And I can see all over the place, you know, that rules and regulations are increasing. The requirements, you know, concerning corporate governance, compliance, social corporate responsibility, et cetera, are growing. What would you say? How can leaders deal with that, you know, conglomerate of new rules and requirements and so on? And where might they even, where do you think they can hinder the development? But on the other hand, where are they maybe also helpful?
Your question creates a very clear distinction between, you know, like the formal side, the compliance, the governance, and the more culture side, the authentic.
Exactly, exactly. And I'd like to talk more about the formal side now.
The formal side, right? So not only compliance and governance gain momentum, but when you face chaos out there, when you have this VUCA, volatile, uncertain, an ambiguous landscape,
complex and so on, yeah,
you need this formal side of leadership, right? This is the foundation, this is the minimum standard to actually enable trust and decision making at the leadership level. If you don't have this, the way I'm looking at this formal side, and this is not about creating a burden of governance which it will hinder progress or will stop value creation or stop decision making. I'm talking purely about creating a protections field for an enterprise. You need that. You need controls. You need mechanisms via which you actually steer the organization in the right way. So for me, it's not a, I'm not looking at it as a challenge. I'm looking at it as a, you need this. This is a non-negotiable. The formal side of governance and compliance is a non-negotiable to actually de-risk the enterprise and to make sure that you have a good decision-making framework, right, that steers the organization in the right direction.
So governance as a facilitator rather than, you know, a hampering element.
Absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely. And if you look at the rules, I don't want to get into cultural elements. We are in Germany, but I'm sure our listeners are maybe from other countries as well.
Mostly from Germany, I must say.
Mostly from Germany, which is great. And there is, rules have a bad rep, right? Maybe for specific cultures, because they rules are being seen as something that's like constrictive and controlling, and it can be, rules can be, if they are being used as a checklist. And if there is no clear leadership in the organization, then it is a problem to have all these rules, right? However, rules can actually be a very, very competitive advantage in a very well-oiled organization. Hmm. And what do I mean by this? Let's take strategy. A company has a strategy. There are rules around how the strategy is being executed. There is a board which supervises and oversees how this strategy is being implemented, executed, and what they need to do to intervene, if they have to intervene, right? And why I'm talking about rules here, if there were no rules, how do you keep accountable your leadership team? How do you make sure they don't run around and, you know, chase rainbows and low-hanging fruit out there? You need to keep the eye on the ball. This is our strategy. This is what we are after. This is how we are being measured. This is how we do it. Talent, take talent. Why do we need diversity and inclusion? Why do we need hiring processes? Because we want to remove biases, and we want to create a fair process in which everybody gets a fair chance. And when decisions are being made, coming back to governance, you have a pool of people from which you can decide what is the best talent for you. Right. So to come back, I think formal side of governance is critical for trust to de-risk the organization and scale. Rules are pivotal to creating this, like almost like the boundary conditions that create clarity around how you can operate in such a way that you move in the right direction.
Sounds very stimulating, you know? I did work in corporate governance, actually, as a managing director of a company that helped companies to install corporate governance systems and, you know, corporate social responsibility frameworks and all that. And I share your point of view. You know, you need these rules. You need, you know, the framework, because otherwise, you know, it can all go astray. And the larger the organization gets, You know, it might become a little bit less flexible, but it can also, it must be organized. And that brings me to my next question. Having these rules and these frameworks versus staying flexible in a very fast changing world and environment, in an unstable environment. What ideas do you have for leaders, you know, to find a good compromise between these two issues?
And to your point, I mean, feel free to disagree. We're having a discussion here, and we want to make sure that the people who listen, they find the conversation valuable, right? So if you disagree, I'm up for a challenge, and I'm also learning here, right? This question actually goes to, this is the fundamental shift in corporate strategy. You cannot just assume that sometimes some things will be dynamic on the market and there's going to be some volatility, some challenges out there. This VUCA, this market dynamics now is a fundamental part of corporate strategy. And it's a fundamental part of a good corporate governance as well. So you cannot isolate this. We live in times and the complexity increases as we go ahead. You cannot say, well, now it's difficult, it's going to be easier, we'll go back to, you know, stable times. And it might not happen. It might not happen. And this is why the corporate strategy has to bake in this uncertainty, this market conditions in such way that the organization adapts, that the organization is resilient, and it can absorb whatever shock can come from the market, right? That's what we are talking. So elasticity in terms of organization while maintaining some integrity. I mean, coming back to the rules we are discussing, you still need integrity. You still need to function in specific parameters and ensure your talent is safe and there is integrity and ethical setup, right? So to summarize, yes, times will not become linear or stable, and leaders should get out of this like efficiency, low-cost sourcing mindset, mm-hmm. and think adaptability and think, you know, how you actually create this organizational resilience so that as you go, the organization is there as an engine to support your ambitions and your goals and whatever priorities you might have.
What does that mean on the global playing field from your point of view? You know, what does that mean for a global player? I'm not so much maybe thinking of the organizations as, you know, that have been global forever almost, you know. But if we're looking to, say, the larger Mittelstand companies, you know, who are a little bit in between, maybe between a medium-sized enterprise and a corporate, what does that mean for them, especially in an international environment?
Very good point, especially since what we find at Gartner, we see that this era of like incremental change, you know, it's coming to an end, and we get into this accelerated type of world. So what leaders, effective leaders, they need to have this ability to create, as I said, organization resilience, but also to create this internal, how can I call it, cohesion almost. And since things are changing, since things are evolving very, very fast, what can you do? Like, look, how can you, what actions you can take? I think that was the question behind
yes.
your...
Yeah, yes, yes, yes.
So what can you do? So you cannot stop risk. You cannot mitigate all risk. You cannot... But what you can do, what-if scenarios. You can anticipate. You can proactively anticipate various scenarios instead of you reacting and being in like an emergency state, crisis, urgency, emergency state, right? You know things are changing. You can look around you. Coming back to how you consume intelligence, how you have very good quantitative and qualitative intelligence. You can look at these risks and you can do scenarios in which you understand what are those maybe lower cost actions that will have a big impact, right, at a larger scale? And how can you actually work with your leaders to make sure that these risks are becoming an asset? Others are doing what you do. Others are actually more nimble and much more quick in terms of addressing this type of risks. The other thing that's very important, as I mentioned in my example earlier, when we talked about the high tech organizations, which had a market performance line. It's very important to anchor your purpose. Things change, right? So the leader should be, should be almost this like chief cohesion officer. The leader should be the calming and the clear voice that guides the team. So if it's chaos outside, this will reflect internally in some anxiety that your talent, your people will feel. So you as a leader, you should actually have the red line. You should reinforce the messages, the purpose, the why it's important, how we are going to communicate to the board, to your people, to the market. It's very important. So it's not just internally, it's also how you communicate to your board, your shareholders, and to the market as well.
And how would you say many of our listeners are from small and medium-sized enterprises. By definition, they've got a lack of resource. So how can you actually address all these challenges, especially in the global environment with limited resources? What would you say?
Absolutely. And yes, I mean, the small, medium businesses are maybe more susceptible. Sorry, it's been a long day.
No problem.
They have a higher risk, right, of failure, exactly, because like you said, they don't have the same means or resources or talent to do all these simulations and scenario planning and whatnot. And also, let's be very realistic, maybe they don't even have the cash buffer to actually absorb a crisis in the supply chain or whatnot, right? So they don't have the same luxury conditions, if I can say. But they do have something very interesting. So I work with a lot of large companies that target small, medium businesses in terms of offerings and whatnot. And we see that a lot of investment is being flown into this organization. Why? Because small, medium businesses have exactly this type of intimacy with their employees and with their customers too. So this, they are more agile, they are more nimble, and they are closer to what the actual end customers want. So this is an asset for me. So coming back, what they can do, I'm not sure if I can come up with like a silver bullet answer here, but it's what I said a bit earlier as well. Do various type of simulations, maybe not at the same scale, but understand what are those lower cost actions that will have the biggest impact if disruption happens, right? And I think that's the key, right? They can still do simulation. They can still have this conversation. They can still look at what are others doing and how they can protect their environment and their organization and their customers if disruption or chaos hits them, right?
Perfect. Coming back to Gartner and your job there, as you said, and as we know, you are accompanying organizations through phases of disruption too, and you mentioned a few examples of that. Given the fact that these disruptions have become quite more the rule rather than the exception, what would you say leaders today, corporate leaders, what qualities must they have today that were not required 10 years ago?
Yes, as we said, the world moved on. A very, very valid question. And the world moved on and things that were relevant. I mean, 10 years ago, digital leadership was about knowing cloud and mobile strategy, right? So right now, if we look at what are those capabilities required that were not... I would say, first of all, is this technology acumen. Maybe it's a broad term, but now you have to be fluent and you have to have a high degree of literacy in AI, in quantum computing. I mean, clients are coming and they are asking us, like, how do we get ready for quantum computing? What do we do? How do we help our organization? How can we help the internal team, right, to be ready and to avoid, to mitigate the risks? Now, what can you do? So yes, it's a must that the leaders nowadays, they need to have this deep expertise in various technologies, which in the past wasn't the case, right? In the past, you might have had leaders who were, you know, a bit more, with a lot more hubris and ego and, you know, I know it all. And every now and then I'm not trying to sound condescending, but these are realities where we're discussing with our clients, right? So this technology acumen is very important right now for leaders. And I referenced a few technologies, AI, quantum computing. Some organization became actually very interested in creating a capability, which in the past wasn't there. And this capability is to continuously scan and synthesize the emerging technologies that are coming in. So Gartner calls it the technology trend radar, right? So look at what industry you are. You are a semiconductor industry or you are a defense industry. So which are those technologies that are coming in the next 2-3 years, next 5 years and beyond that? I'm not even talking about maverick research, which looks far beyond like 15 years in the future, right? I'm talking about the hype cycle of Gartner and technologies that are impactful. So what we do to help leaders, we help them create this continuous foresight capability so that they can see and they can strategize before they are being disrupted, right? And I think this is a very interesting shift in the mindset. So first, how you look at technology and how, I mean, look at people, look at Satya Nadella, look at Jensen Huang, look at these people are deep, they talk technology beyond the fantastic things that they have done. They're really technology minded, truly visionary. Now, I'm not saying everybody should be Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying this is becoming a norm for leaders nowadays. Mm-hmm. We get lots of questions in terms of enhancing the literacy alongside specific technologies, having this, as I said, the continuous foresight capability that helps them plan, prepare, assess, right? So this alongside the technology. The other point that I would like to, more from an operational perspective. So as we mentioned earlier, those stable times where, you know, linear type of thinking and the leaders would function in a more stable conditions are long gone. Right now, the leaders are being, the demand on them is then the pressure is very high because they are being asked to be flexible, to act in this non-linear setup. But what do I mean by that? They need to take quick decisions while they constantly plan for the next. This is not an easy thing. I mean, being a leader in today's time, it's actually a phenomenal type of endorsement and exercise, right? So this act, think about the talent. How can I deploy, reskill, and deploy the best talent for the most urgent business need, right? How can I do that? This is like the constant planning and decisioning that you have to do. Hence, the governance is so important, having the blueprints to actually making the right decisions.
In this context, what are the major risks that leaders underestimate from your experience, and why are they often too late? You were talking about, and you were talking in your example about this, the performance dip of the technology company, who was obviously too late, you know, underestimated some risks. So what are those and why are they late?
I mean, as I mentioned earlier, what we find is that a lot of this, the biggest challenges, the biggest risks are not always external. Mm-hmm. The biggest risks are very well anchored in the internal setup, in how the organization works. And companies do transformations, especially the industries I function in do lots of transformations, ERP rollouts, AI adoption, mergers, whatnot, cloud migration, lots of very big transformations, right? What we find, and this is coming back to your biggest risks, 17%, this is going to be very scary, right? 17% of these transformations are being seen successful. 25% completely fail, right? And the rest are compromised. So I'm talking 55% plus. It's just like, these are scary stats. If you think about very large transformations that these leaders oversee, all these transformations demand, add pressure and attention on the same talent pool, or on the same manager. So it's impossible. There is something called transformation fatigue. There is something called change fatigue. I'm sure a lot of the people who listen to us are very familiar with this type of thing. But coming back to your question, and the reasons why this is happening, why the stats are so low, why only 17%, again, 17%, that's a 1/7, that's very low, are seen successful. There are a plethora of reasons, right? From lacking a vision to bad data, trust in the data, coming back to what we were discussing, to uninspiring leadership, to unrealistic business case, or even lack of a benefit case. Why are we doing this, right? And there are various reasons for this. And lastly, I mean, you asked, why are they late? Mm-hmm. In managing or mitigating these risks? Well, I think there are some biases in play here. Coming back to the high-tech company that I mentioned earlier. So what do I mean by biases in place? There is always this illusion of control, and there is the myopia of success, right? Let me clarify this, right? So we at Gartner, we run lots of surveys. We interview CEOs for different industries. We try to understand like what matters, what are the important characteristics of a leader, from coaching to adaptability to various characteristics. And we can talk in more details if, I don't know how much time we have today to do it, but I'm happy to talk about this. But when we ask leaders and if we ask employees, leaders have this tendency of inflate or they sense that they have a better grip of reality internally and externally than they actually do. So this is the illusion of control. And this is because they don't trust the data. This is because the intelligence in the company is very siloed, right? And what can you do? And the myopia of success, to the example I gave at the beginning of our conversation with the HT company, we are successful. We have cash cows. We have big clients that pay us. We have a brand that's being known. They didn't ask themselves, like, what's my identity? How do I differentiate from my competition? Why would they choose us over other clients, right? How do we create this modern go-to-market approach? And the reason for this myopia of success, proximity creates blind spots. And past success creates barrier to change. It's easier, it's the comfort zone. I've been doing well so far. Why would I change? Why would I pressure test again my organization? And also very importantly, so one is on the myopia of success, right? It's first of this past success creates a psychological barrier, but at the same time, the do-nothing scenario is attractive, exactly because they've been successful, right? So I think this is why a lot of organizations react late, and this has major implications on the people, on the sunk cost, on how the company remains competitive on the market, on what type of product services you take to the market. So implications are very, very big. If you don't mitigate the risk, if your leadership cannot act quickly, right? So I think it's a very complex type of question that you've asked, and the answer is not a simple one, of course.
Yeah, but you gave a few very interesting insights, which I personally, in my humble opinion, I would completely share, and have also seen as a corporate manager quite often in my previous life. Adela, I don't know if I can ask this. It's one question, but you talked about the NVIDIA CEO. Do you have any favorite corporate leaders at all? I'm not sure if you can mention names in your role, but maybe you can. I don't know. Describe the type of corporate leader who is your favorite.
I didn't randomly reference Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, nor Jensen Huang,
yeah,
because I am conscious that I'm referencing two corporate leaders which are from the same industry, which is technology,
yeah,
right? But maybe if I can add a bit of nuance to explain why these people are, for me personally, very inspirational, right? And there are lots of people out there, lots of leaders. We could have picked, I don't know, Henry Ford, whatever, to talk about it. So it's absolutely fine. We can talk about different type of leaders, but for me personally, I am mesmerized by Satya Nadella, because he's not a transactional leader. He doesn't just focus on results. He's a transformational leader. So he took Microsoft from a stagnant position and took them to a growth mindset and led them to a cloud dominance position, right? And I will cover both quantitative and qualitative aspects to just to add a bit more. He's a homegrown leader, right? I mean, he's been with Microsoft pretty much his entire career, which is an asset for him. In nowadays, when people jump from one job to another, actually, if you look at what Satya did, he's a homegrown talent, and he is maybe the best CEO hire of all times since 2014, when this guy came to lead Microsoft, right? He spotted the cloud momentum. They missed search, they missed a number of things, but he saw the cloud momentum. He did. And he took Azure from 1 billion to 66 billion run rate. The total revenues are up 2 times, right? Earnings 3 times, the total share price 10 times. This guy, since 2014, added $3 trillion in value to Microsoft. This is unmatched. This is unheard of. Look at Intel. Intel messed it up so many times, right? They've been through these cycles of getting the right CEO. But Microsoft, so Satya Nadella, he's phenomenal. And yes, numbers speak. Performance is important. But he took, I don't know if you read the book of Carol Dweck, Mindset, The Psychology of Success. He took philosophy of that book and institutionalized it in Microsoft. So they went from a know-it-all culture to a learn-it-all culture.
Yeah.
Not only that, coming back, what does it mean from a governance perspective? So this is a phenomenal leader, but what does it mean from a governance perspective? Satya baked in the decision-making process empathy. He talks so passionately about, I will talk about mission and culture until I'm bored stiff, but I will reinforce this message until the end of the day, because this is the only way in which we'll deliver better products, in which we'll have better team and an adaptable organization. Coming back of how you create the adaptable organization, right? He also had a very strong stance on sustainability and ethics, publicly taking a, and especially in the light of AI. I mean, he's done some pretty amazing things. He talks about Microsoft being a platform and a partner cloud-first organization. He favored partnerships over competition, which was a vital governance shift in the thinking of how you can survive in this multi-platform world. For me, this was exceptionally interesting. Everything that this guy is, I would study this guy in more detail, because I think it's phenomenal what he's done. And similarly, Jensen, right? Jensen is like the testimony that you can be a leader and just manage multi decades of disruptive technological disruption. this guy would stay on the stage and talk about being a chief revenue destroyer, about his own products, a chief revenue destroyer, because he says, well, this is better than the previous versions that we've had. Imagine the next year. Imagine what nervousness you'll create to his customer base by saying this. He would talk about three or four, the roadmap of his products, far in the future, photonics and whatnot, because he's confident in the way, in the long-term strategy that he had, right? I mean, for me, this is phenomenal, what the way he saw the graphic processing units in parallel computing, the investments he's done in infrastructure, even before the market confirmed specific type of needs. Absolutely impressive. But just to circle back to when we started this conversation, right, about the board, what Jensen Dodds did phenomenally well. So we talked about the challenge of balancing short-term performance with long-term resilience.
Yeah.
Of course, this board will want performance and immediate results. So what did Jensen do? He created a super discipline. He partnered with the board, created a super disciplined, supportive board to his long-term vision. Right. This is a phenomenal, this is the hallmark of amazing corporate governance, because he truly made the board his partner. Imagine these people. So we talk about tens of years before they are building the AI infrastructure out there. They are not just doing chips. It's a phenomenal company to study. And what Jensen managed to pull off with NVIDIA, again, absolutely phenomenal. Similarly, for what he's done internally, so numbers speak for themselves. The vision he had, the way he managed the board to stick by his vision, phenomenal. But the culture, he's a big fan of flat organizations. He's notoriously known for managing 60, 80 people. Why? Because he can fluidize the thinking, the information flow, and the decision making, right? I think again, another example of some phenomenal leaders, same industry, but truly inspirational people who made some very, very bold bets and who were able to actually turn governance in an asset, if I can say so. So
that's the thing, you know, he's actually extending his knowledge base by working with the board, as you said it before, rather than, you know, seeing them as a burden. And the other thing which comes to my mind reminds me of Steve Jobs, who said, you know, good people do not need to be managed. So obviously, to say it to oversimplify it maybe a little bit, you know, it's easy to manage 68 people, you know, if they manage themselves, you know, or it's easier. But that is fantastic as a final insight from your vast experience with leaders and C-level executives. It was a great pleasure having you, Adela, a real inspiration for me, at least, and I'm pretty sure for all our listeners too. And I'm looking forward to seeing you very soon, hopefully in Frankfurt.
Thank you so much, Armin. Thank you.